a spaghetti factory, and also come to the Sunday vigils at the Hollywood Max, and that's Sundays from 6 to 8. We need to show a wide variety of folks who are caring. We need to have you come tomorrow, July 12th. Go to the website to find out the latest start place, because we're talking about Elizabeth Carruthers Park on 3508 Southwest Moody, between the bottom of the tram and the ice, or at the Willamette Park, where there's lots of free parking.
That looks like the end of our time, but I want to thank Sally and Edie for coming and blurbing upcoming things that people can come to. Thanks a lot for listening, and good morning.
KABU hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KABU at the Clinton. This month, we'll screen the film Behemoth on Thursday, July 12th at 7 p.m. Behemoth is a Chinese documentary showing the dehumanizing impact of coal mining. After the film will be a discussion on clean energy alternatives. Again, that's a film screening of the documentary Behemoth, Thursday, July 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee has been rescheduled to July 11th at 7 p.m. Please join us.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KABU for the remainder of the morning at 9. Just in a few seconds, we'll be listening to On the Ground Radio, looking back today at 25 years of anti-death penalty activism. At 10 o'clock, Eric Cascadia reports live from Occupy ICE PDX, interviews and updates from the encampment at Portland's Immigration Field Office. At 10:30, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. So that's a whole half hour of Eric Cascadia. And then at 10:30, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, we got the Dirt Bag today, answering your gardening questions and more. And all of these KABU programs are made possible by members' support. And if you want to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. KABU programming is made possible by KABU member listeners and support from Oregon Symphony, located at 909 Southwest Washington Street in downtown Portland. Presenting Gary Trudeau, political cartoonist and creator of Doonesbury Comics, sharing from his latest book, Sad, Doonesbury in the Time of Trump. Tuesday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information available by phone at 503-228-1353 or online at OregonSymphony.org. And here we go with On the Ground Radio.
From Washington, D.C., this is On the Ground. On today's show, contrary to the national trend of police officers not being charged for killing unarmed men, women, and children, a police officer has been charged in the shooting death of 17-year-old Antoine Rose Jr. in East Pittsburgh. We speak to the attorney for the teenager's family.
We have a witness standing right there in the window shooting the video, saying, "I didn't hear him say one word. He just started shooting."
And for 25 years, activists opposed to the death penalty have been holding an annual vigil and fast in front of the Supreme Court.
Derek Jameson, he was on death row in Ohio for 20 years, a young black man when he went in, had no knowledge that crime had even taken place. It was a false identification, but he was on death row for 20 years. He watched 54 people that he got to know while he was on death row that led off to their death. His mother died while he was on death row. He couldn't even go to her funeral or anything like that.
All that and much more coming up. Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Ivarum. On this week of the July 4th Independence Holiday, people here in D.C. and around the country continued protests over the Trump administration's immigration policies that are continuing to separate children from their parents. This is despite a June 27th ruling from a federal judge that separated children must be reunited with their parents by 2 weeks after that date. This week, another federal judge, James Boasberg, here in D.C., ruled that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, must follow its own rules and release asylum seekers on parole if they are not a flight risk or a danger to the community. The ruling was in response to a lawsuit, Damus versus Nielsen, filed in March by the American Civil Liberties Union on behalf of a group of asylum seekers in U.S. custody. The lawsuit predates the Justice Department's zero tolerance policy that all adults crossing the border without visas will be prosecuted. Chantel James attended Saturday's Families Belong Together rally in Lafayette Park in front of the White House and filed this report.
It's my body, my choice.
Her body, her choice.
Shame, 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 shame.
On Saturday, a march of 30,000 convened in Lafayette Square, just outside the White House, to voice their emphatic opposition to Trump's zero-tolerance immigration policy, which has seen more than 2,000 children separated from their parents and sparked mass outrage. The action was held concurrently with protests in many cities across the nation, but people from all over the country traveled for miles to be present here in D.C. alongside residents of the metro area. Sponsoring organizations included the Women's March and MoveOn.org. The rally's program featured speeches and performances by guests like Alicia Keys. We spoke to members of the crowd to get their perspectives.
My name's John and hers is Anna.
Okay, yeah. And you all come from Jacksonville,
yeah,
Florida?
Yeah, Jacksonville, Florida.
And so what was it that that moved you to come all the way up from Jacksonville, Florida to be here today?
I just think this immigration thing was the last straw for us. We just feel we're tired of being silent and being... just feel like we're being run over and not being represented by our government.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we just felt strongly about this. When it comes to children, they should be sacred.
Right. So explain the signs that you guys have brought.
Okay, well, this right here is, I love to read the Bible stories.
It says Jesus was a refugee.
Yes. So the story is, he was a refugee.
So you guys believe that the U.S. should be a place where all refugees can come for asylum?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. That's what our country stands for.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the liberty of America stands for.
Andrea, we're actually from New York. We want to know first, where are the children and why were they taken and when will they be reunited? We just don't feel this is fair. This is not right. People are leaving their country because they're scared and they're coming here seeking asylum and we don't give it to them. And we jail them, we cage them, we take their children, we put their children in cages. It's horrifying.
My name is Eric Lynam. I live in Vienna, Virginia. I came out basically to support this protest about these missing children and that this illegal, the so-called illegal immigration, this is a horrible policy that the Trump administration is accomplishing. And I came basically to show solidarity for the parents who can't find their children, who don't know where their children are, and it's shameful that this is happening in America.
From Lafayette Square, this is Chantal James.
Thank you, Chantal. Well, those working for a clean environment also enjoyed a mini victory on Thursday when Scott Pruitt resigned as head of the Environmental Protection Agency after months of ongoing scandals, the latest being his apparent effort to use his position to secure a high-paying job for his wife. While the forced resignation was considered a small victory, it was short-lived because Pruitt is being replaced by Andrew Wheeler, a former lobbyist for the coal industry and for a variety of other polluting corporations. And while the D.C. bureaucracy has not been the best steward for our natural resources, scores of young people interested in science and technology, including on-the-ground intern Davette Williams, attended the Congress of the National Academy of Future Scientists and Technologists, which ended in Boston on Sunday. The speaker who made the biggest impression on Davette was Sylvia Earle, marine biologist and first female chief scientist of the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. At 82 years of age, Earle is a National Geographic Explorer in residence. David wrote this week that Earle inspired her to take care of the planet and protect the oceans. The On the Ground team was also on hand at a recent D.C. council hearing on protecting a neighborhood landmark, an open space for community recreation. The Alexander Crummell School has been a historic landmark in the Ivy City community in Northeast D.C. since it was built in 1911. Since the property has been closed for more than 40 years, there has been many debates on what to do with the school. On Wednesday, June 27th, the D.C. Council held a hearing on how the school and the land around it will be used in a new development that will bring new condominium homes and retail spaces to the historic community. Romaine B. Thomas, former D.C. school principal and mother of former D.C. Councilman Harry Thomas Jr., grew up in Ivy City and attended the Crummell School. She spoke at the hearing.
I was born at home on Montello Avenue in Ward 5 and part of Ivy City, and I continue to live in the Woodridge, Brooklyn community with the family home on Trinidad Avenue. I am pleased to appear before you this morning as a supporter and friend of the Crummell School Friends Group, of which I am also a member. And this is a source of pride, and the source of pride is that I attended Crummell School and returned as to teach at Crummell School. As you know, this now historic site honors the life and legacy of Reverend Alexander Crummell. He was a leading abolitionist and champion for Black lives. Along with many other people, I continue to be highly interested and passionate about the past, the present, and the future of the Crummell School site and property. I have participated in the struggle to reclaim Crummell School as a functional site, a vibrant, meaningful building, and beautiful site for the community and city to enjoy. From the current design, it appears to provide very limited use for outdoor recreation and may even limit the use by the Ivy City community. This was the major concern of the Friends Group and neighbors, as well as families and children. This is the understanding that I have as of today. I urge you to give great consideration to the merits of this aspect of the proposal.
Council members in attendance, including Mary Che and Kenya McDuffie, stated their interest in supporting a compromise reached between the community and Ivy City developers, which won the redevelopment contract. And finally, in culture and media, the first annual DC Pan-African Festival, Living the Nguzu Saba, is being held Saturday, July 7th, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. at 1327 Rhode Island Avenue in Northeast D.C. More information is on the Facebook event page. In sports, two soccer superstars, Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo, have been eliminated from the World Cup happening in Russia. And also, the basketball superstar, LeBron James, is leaving the East Coast and heading to the Los Angeles Lakers. James, a four-time NBA MVP, announced Sunday night that he has agreed to a four-year contract with the Lakers. He has joined one of the league's most storied franchises. Many fans in D.C. and on the East Coast in general wanted James to stay in the East to maintain some balance of power, but no such luck. In the World Cup, Messi's Argentina and Ronaldo's Portugal are eliminated. The quarterfinals, underway as we go to broadcast, feature Uruguay, France, Brazil, Belgium, Sweden, England, Russia, and Croatia. And finally, fans of hip-hop superstar Drake are scooping up his new double album, Scorpion, which some critics say is bloated with the artist's usual amount of navel-gazing, while still containing infectious beats and hooks. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, Gerald Horn on Mexico and today's launch of Trump's new trade war. Stay with us.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Hey. Hey. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Ivarum. And now we're turning to more international news with On the Ground's geopolitical analyst, the professor, historian, and prolific author, Gerald Horn. And Gerald, the election of Andrés Manuel López Obrador as Mexico's new president must still top the list for international headlines. So I want to know what you think about this, how huge this is, and what difference it can make as Mexico connects with both its southern neighbors, the rest of Latin America, and also its neighbors to the north, U.S. and Canada.
This is a huge victory. It's a seismic shift. It's a political earthquake. It's a victory for Cuba, Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, and CARICOM, the Caribbean nations. It will lead to Mexico tightening relations with China and Russia. It will lead to boost in pensions for the elderly in Mexico. It will lead to lowering or eliminating tuition for college students in Mexico. Keep in mind as well that AMLO, the name with which he is called, has also suggested that wages for Mexican workers need to rise so that the discrepancy between U.S. and Mexican labor in terms of wages will be reduced or eliminated, reducing the possibility that there will be runaway shops from the United States to Mexico. Now, if our organizations on this side of the border were up to speed, they would be sending delegations to meet with their counterparts in Mexico City sooner rather than later. I'm speaking, for example, of the Congressional Black Caucus, which should be organizing a delegation that would include the NAACP and other organizations to meet with our friends across the border. I would say the same for Pacifica, which probably needs to start collaborating more closely with its media counterparts south of the border. I would also give advice to AMLO, and I regret having to say this, but given the depth of the change that's taking place in Mexico, he would be well advised to contact our friends in Cuba with regard to tightening his own security. Now, AMLO also says that this transformation that just took place in July 2018 is the fourth major transformation in the history of Mexico. He speaks of the decade from 1810 to about 1820-21, when there was the struggle for independence from Mexico, which led directly to the abolition of slavery in Mexico, particularly under the leadership of a president of African descent, Vicente Guerrero, who in turn began to attract enslaved Africans from Texas to flee to Mexico, which helped to exacerbate tensions with the United States, leading to a war with the United States that led to Mexico losing a significant percentage of its territory. Then there was the Mexican Revolutionary Decade, 1910 to 1920, which was pro-poor. Recall that that was during the time when the black heavyweight boxing champion from Galveston, Texas, Jack Johnson, exiled himself in Mexico City and sought to establish a base in Mexico through which he could lead a struggle against lynching and Jim Crow in this country. And then in the late 1930s, when President Cárdenas was elected and he nationalized oil, and that helped to set off developments that led to another flood of African-American migrants to Mexico City, including Elizabeth Catlett, who is probably our leading sculptress. Now, AMLO is in office, or at least he'll be in office on December 1. And once again, it's difficult to overestimate the consequences of this seismic shift, this political earthquake that just took place in Mexico.
Well, as we go to broadcast, Trump's trade war, especially with China, is supposed to be launched, go into effect, and the world is watching for the impact. I did see, for example, that Iran says it will block the Strait of Hormuz if the U.S. tries to keep it from exporting oil. And the U.S. claims that it will keep that key waterway open. And it sounds like that could turn into some type of military confrontation.
Well, with regard to Iran, the Trump team has suggested that by early November, it's expecting those countries that get oil from Iran to stop doing so. And if they don't, Mr. Trump has suggested that he will slap sanctions on those countries, and that could further worsen relations with China in particular, which is a major purchaser of Iranian oil. And likewise, with regard to this trade war, which will be commencing on July 6th, Friday, China is a major target, along with the European Union, but also Mexico, Canada, and Japan. Now, Boris Johnson, the British Foreign Secretary, says that there's method in Mr. Trump's madness. And if you take that notion seriously, you may want to try to put this trade war in the context of a kind of grand strategy that the Trump team is developing. I would suggest that they're trying to convert Canada into a vassal state, a kind of puppet state. They would like to split the European Union, cut a deal with France, which, by the way, according to the Guardian of London, is already on offer, smash Germany with the aid of right-wing forces in Poland, neutralize Russia, hence the meeting with Putin in a few days, smash the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, because if Russia is neutralized, certainly there is little need for NATO, and even if it is not neutralized, there's little need for NATO, and then, with all of that under your belt, confront the People's Republic of China, which is seen as the big enchilada. Now, contrast that with Hillary Clinton and the Democrats, who would have pursued a more traditional grand strategy of uniting with the European Union and NATO to confront Russia and China. Now, from the viewpoint of U.S. imperialism, it's hard to say if the Clinton strategy or the Trump strategy would be more effective. From the point of view of the U.S. left, labor, and the oppressed, of course, both are disastrous. I would also say that Canada is particularly vulnerable, given the fact that it only has 10% of the U.S. population of about 340 million. Canada obviously should try to cut its own deal with Russia, but like the United States, it's trapped by the fact that in Canada there's this large population of hardcore anti-communist Eastern European descent, including the person who's in charge of Canadian foreign policy. I'm speaking of Chrystia Freeland. Germany is particularly vulnerable. There are thousands of U.S. troops on German soil. It's surrounded by U.S. allies, not only Poland, but the neo-fascists in Italy, not to mention the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. I should also mention in this context that part of the crisis in Germany that almost led to Chancellor Merkel being toppled this week has everything to do with the disastrous 2011 overthrow of the Gaddafi regime in Libya, which has turned Libya into a gateway for Africans trying to cross the Mediterranean into Europe and then heading to Germany. The result of constant negotiations in the Merkel coalition has been a deal that will certainly lead to more racial profiling, not only of people crossing into Europe without papers, but I would say any dark-skinned person who is trying to cross a European border. Now, I would also say that the political elites of both Canada and Germany, in some way they remind me of communist parties during the era of Gorbachev and Yeltsin and the impending collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, in both cases, neither side can really believe what's going on. They can't believe what's happening. And I think there's a lesson for the U.S. left as well, which is that, like a seesaw, when the left declines, as it has done since 1989, you can expect sooner rather than later for the right to rise, which is precisely the result in Washington and now in Europe.
And finally, I don't want to forget Yemen being attacked by U.S.-backed Saudi forces. More than 100,000 people have died. More than 100,000 people have been displaced by the recent and current attack on the port city of Hodeidah, and millions are facing famine.
Apparently, every few minutes, a child dies in Yemen, not least because of war and famine. And yet, when you examine the U.S. corporate media, what you see are stories about alleged missiles from Yemen flying into Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, which then gives sustenance to this idea that Washington should be intervening more forcefully with the Saudis to suppress those that they call the Houthis in Yemen.
Well, we won't forget Yemen, the Congo, Gaza, or other parts of occupied Palestine, where Israel this week forcibly removed a village of Bedouins to make room for another Jewish-only settlement. I've been speaking with our geopolitical analyst, Gerald Horn. Thank you so much for joining me today, Gerald.
Thank you.
I know the truth is you won't love me until I'm gone. And even anything that comes after is moving on. I can't even capture the feeling I had at first. Meeting all my heroes like seeing how magic works. The people I looked up to are going from bad to worse. The actions out of character even when they rehearse. Working in the land of the free, the home of the brave. I gotta bring my brothers or else I feel out of place. Breaking speed records on roads that these paved. And they don't like that, it's written all on their face. I don't know how I'ma make it out of here clean. Can't even keep track of who plays for the other team. Iconic duos ripping split at the seams. Good-hearted people are taking it to extremes. Leaving me in limbo to question what I believe. Leaving me to ask what's their motive in making peace. Leaving me to not trust anybody I meet. Leaving me to ask is there anybody like me.
This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Ivarum. And contrary to the disturbing national trend of police not being held accountable for killing unarmed men, women, and children, a police officer has been charged in the shooting death of 17-year-old Antoine Rose Jr. in East Pittsburgh. On the line is Fred Rabner, attorney for the teenager's family. Thank you for joining me today, Fred.
I appreciate you having me.
Well, as I just mentioned, we've all seen several cases around the country in recent years where officers have not faced any charges, have not been charged in what seem to be very blatant cases of police brutality, murder of unarmed men, women, and children. And people, I think, have become somewhat numb to this. So tell me why you think that there's a difference, what the difference is in terms of what's happened in Pittsburgh with Michael Rosfeld being charged in the killing, in the murder of Antoine Rose.
Wouldn't it be nice if our dialogue didn't include that caveat that officers often aren't charged when it seems like they are caught on video perpetrating what seems to be very intentional criminal acts? But let me address the question that you asked. In this case, the officer from East Pittsburgh, Michael Rosfeld, was charged around 9 or 10 days after the incident. I have theorized that the reason I believe that he has been charged with criminal homicide is based on multiple collective reasonings. And I think the first one that's worth mentioning is this was recorded on video. And I think when you consider the fact that there was a videotape of this incident, a very vivid, clear videotape from beginning to end of the officer poised at the doorway of the vehicle that was stopped. Antoine Rose the second was in the passenger seat of that vehicle. While that officer was poised with his gun out, giving some type of commands, which you can videotape that was captured, because East Pittsburgh somehow is in the Stone Ages and has no audio recording and or video recording through the body cams or the cruiser cams. They have no equipment whatsoever, but thankfully the officer was so belligerent in the manner in which he was talking to the motorist that the young lady who was in the window had started her videotape and captured this. But what you see when the video picks up, as the officer standing poised, and you see Antoine Rose II in a white T-shirt running away from the officer, clearly out of the direction, opposite direction where the officer's standing, with his back to the officer, in no threatening position. The officer's in no fear of any harm whatsoever to he or others. There's clearly nothing in Antoine Rose's hands, and yet he lets off 3 shots in rapid succession, striking him from behind and throwing him to the ground and killing him. So the first answer to the question is why this case resulted in the filing of criminal charges against Michael Rosfeld. I think the first reason is we have a video capturing the incident, so no one can deny it, sweep it under the rug, rationalize it away, or cloud the issue later based on some conflicting testimony of what took place.
So I wanted to follow up on the whole issue of the video, and I'm thinking about the case of Walter Scott in South Carolina, shot to death by Michael Slager. And in that case, there was video taken by a bystander who captured Michael Slager basically shooting Walter Scott in the back several times. And despite this video evidence and charges being brought, there was a hung jury. There was one juror who just could not bring themselves to convict Michael Slager of shooting Walter Scott in the back, and there was a hung jury. And then after a while, months later, Slager was convicted of federal civil rights charges, which sent him to prison for Walter Scott's death. So this is a case where there was video, there were charges, but based on the jury, Michael Slager still was not convicted. So I want you to talk about how that kind of case can relate to the situation now in East Pittsburgh.
Exactly. And you bring up a good point. And what we said in our team, our legal team has said from the beginning of hearing that these charges were filed, was that this is just a first step. The fact that this officer is charged 9 days after the incident is just a first step. I mean, in that case where Leon Ford was paralyzed, he was charged in 36 hours, shackled to his bed and guarded by police within 36 hours. The first officer who responded to the scene to investigate the officer-involved shooting of him listed Leon Ford as the suspect within an hour of getting to the scene. So the fact that 9 days took place is a demonstration that there's still some bias towards giving police the benefit of the doubt. But even though charges are filed, you bring up a great point. That's only the first mile in a marathon. Really, what you're faced with in the case that you brought to bear is a tainted jury pool that has inherent bias. So even though you think you're picking what seem to be, by the answers they're giving in the jury colloquy, they're giving seemingly answers that show that they're fair and unbiased, but in reality, we know there's an inherent bias in favor of police. But you bring up a great point. Here we are looking at clear facts where an individual is running away, in that case, not even quickly. He's of no harm to the officer, and the officer shoots him as if it's like a video game. And that's similar here, similar fact pattern. And we have a lot of work to do. You know, my partner and I have talked about the fact that, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. We have to change something to get a fair jury. We have to get a change here to get a fair investigation in these types of cases. There needs to be stronger legislature with respect to the investigative bodies that are assigned. For example, here, the county police are investigating local officers. Now, county is different than East Pittsburgh or the city of Pittsburgh or all the different townships here. It's a different agency, but they're still closely entwined. We think that it would probably be more appropriate in the future, and we're looking at legislature in this regard. There's a local organization here called BPEP, and they've already submitted legislature, which the district attorney here of Allegheny County has agreed that he would not contest, and that legislature would say that the attorney general's office would do the investigation in such matters. So you get a statewide investigation instead of a local branch investigating people that they probably know, and that's a problem.
And the other case I thought about, of course, was the case of Michael Brown in Ferguson, because in that case, the police officer who was not actually interviewed for a long time or formally interviewed for a long time after Michael Brown was killed was able to kind of gather all these other extenuating circumstances that weren't really related to the moment that he killed Michael Brown. And so he was able to bring in the issue of, you know, had Michael Brown stolen some cigars from a store, and claim that that was the reason why he stopped Michael Brown and the altercation led to Michael Brown's death. So similarly, as a jury or the public learns more about the car that Antoine Rose was in, that, you know, this car possibly being related to a drive-by shooting, and how do you keep those types of incidents from being brought into the picture when they really had nothing to do with the moment that Antoine Rose was shot in the back and killed?
You know, there's two sides to that. There's how much will it be used and how much should it be able to be used. So in reality, if you're looking at it from a criminal perspective, meaning the criminal charges filed against Michael Rosefeld, and if you're then the second way to look at it is in a civil matter, for the wrongful death of Antoine Rose II based on unreasonable use of force. So that's constitutional violation. So the one will be civil, one will be criminal. In a criminal arena, looking at it from the officer's defense of the case, you know, he's going to be able to introduce what the cause for the stop was, what was in his mindset as far as the information about the stop, because that's going to be relevant. There's something called an imperfect self-defense, and that's going to be relevant because they're probably going to try to say that even though he didn't see a weapon, in his mind he knew of this previous incident, and he was heightened up and in a heightened state, and that he was not, quote-unquote, intending to kill, didn't have a motive, if you will, to kill this individual. Didn't develop one in that brief period of time. The reality that I think is the flip side of that coin is, you're an officer, you have a gun, you know what is a permissive shoot, and you know what's not a permissive shoot based on the training, and you didn't even take a step towards this individual. You didn't yell, stop or I'll shoot. Instead, you sat there like you're in a shooting gallery and calmly let off three rounds in rapid succession into his back, and also one hit the back, one hit his cheek or face, and the other one hit his elbow, I believe, but all from the rear. But the point being that no matter what you thought, that's never appropriate. So that's the answer as far as the criminal. In civil, it's a little different. There's something called the totality of circumstances, that we look at the snapshot of what the officer was aware of during the time that he chose to use deadly force. And one of the things in that is whether or not you gave a fair warning. And if you did give a fair warning, did you give the individual an opportunity to heed that fair warning before using deadly force? And if you did not do that, it's automatically an improper use of deadly force. So the jury would be charged on that aspect.
And then also, in a lot of these cases, in other jurisdictions, prosecutors, district attorneys have fallen to the whole strategy of sending the case to a grand jury. We learn in those cases that the prosecutors really didn't have to do that. They didn't have to send it to the grand jury. They could have brought charges themselves. And the grand jury was like a method of basically taking the case out of their hands, basically, and putting it into another process that could be very nebulous, where they wouldn't have to be accountable. They wouldn't have to take responsibility for actually prosecuting the case.
In this case, the district attorney announced in a press conference the full reason why he's filed charges, and he was very adamant on some very important things, one of which was he said Antoine Rose did nothing wrong that evening. He would not have been charged had he lived for his behavior, that his hands were empty when he ran. And earlier in the evening, the incident that preceded the stop, the district attorney was clear about saying that he did not think that Antoine Rose II did anything that he would have been criminally culpable for anyway. And that's important, just for a court of public opinion also.
And then the final thing I wanted to ask you about was the fact that Michael Rosfeld was released on $250,000 unsecured bail. Give us some insight into why that was. You know, what is unsecured bail, and why would he have such a low bar to meet for such a serious charge when, you know, most of the public thinks that if any of us, you know, shoot to death someone, then, you know, we would have face a much stiffer bail.
Well, anytime you're charged with homicide, there's usually, in this county, no bond. Until you have a fact-finding hearing under which some facts are developed, many lawyers will then make a motion to set a bond, making an argument that the chance of succeeding on first-degree homicide or felony homicide, both which are life in prison, that happens often. But to have an unsecured bond means that a magistrate, without a judge, without a hearing, that a magistrate issued a bond, which is essentially a piece of paper saying, if you sign your name here, I will let you out without paying a dollar. And you won't pay a dollar, and you will be out of jail. And the only thing that could happen is if you didn't show up for court, then the county could sue out the $250,000 bond that you signed. Now, this same magistrate, you can't even have a traffic hearing unless you pay $50. So he didn't even set the bond as high as he would for a traffic violation. That's insulting. I'm disgusted by it. No one else understands it either. I don't know how it happened, and I'm not going to surmise how it happened. I'm annoyed by it. I'm kind of puzzled by it. But, you know, I'm going to focus on the actual matter at hand, which is the prosecution and securing a conviction, because in reality, whether we like it or not, the fellow who's arrested has no prior record and lives in the area, has ties in the area. I think the officer might have modified it so that he has an ankle bracelet now. I'm not sure. But yeah, it is very rare. It was disgusting to hear. And it's not my place. I have no power to do anything about it because it's not my litigation. It's the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania through their district attorneys, and they would have to take exception with the bond if they felt that it was appropriate. And there could be strategic reasons not to. I can't really discuss them now.
Well, okay. And in the meantime, is he still on the force? Is he getting paid?
My understanding is on leave. I'm not sure whether it's unpaid or paid leave, but we are of the belief that he should be terminated. Not even for this incident, for them now knowing what his previous history was with the University of Pittsburgh police.
Well, I want to thank Fred Rabner, attorney for the family of Antoine Rose Jr. I want to thank him for joining me today. The next steps in the case is that there will be a pretrial hearing and then a trial date will be set. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital on Pacifica Radio. I'm Esther Avarum. Stay with us. Take heed.
It's a rolling, not a stop. Watch, don't ever stop. This the flow that got the block hot, got super hot. Ay, give me my respect, give me my respect. I just took it left like I'm ambidex. I moved through London with the Euro steps. Got a sneaker deal and I ain't break a sweat. Catch me cause I'm gone, out of there I'm gone. High, I go from 6 to 23 like I'm LeBron. Serving up a pack, serving up a pack. Pulling gimmicks cause they scared of rap. Ay. Funny how they shook, ay. Got them shook. Pulling back the curtain by myself, take a look. Ay. I'm a bar spitter, I'm a hard hitter. Yeah, I'm light skinned.
And now for our final segment. For 25 years, activists opposed to the death penalty have been holding an annual vigil and fast in front of the Supreme Court. I spoke to folks from the organizations Death Penalty Action, Starving for Justice, and Journey of Hope, From Violence to Healing, participating in the action.
I'm Reverend Doctor, if you will, Jack Sullivan Jr. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, but I live now in Findlay, Ohio, where I pastor First Christian Church Disciple to Christ.
And tell me why you're out here today. You said that everybody out here has a story.
Yes, well, 21 years ago, I lost my baby sister Jennifer to a homicide in Cleveland, a cold case. We don't know who killed her. And conventional wisdom practiced by many would call for me to be out for revenge and retribution and find the person or people who did this to Jennifer and have them arrested and tried, convicted, and executed. Well, we are not anti-accountability, but we are anti-death penalty, because death penalty is hollow. It has no redemptive properties. It does not help us to grieve or give us wholeness. Does not restore us at all. It just continues that vicious cycle of death. And we all believe that there are better ways to address violent crime than continuing violence, which is the death penalty.
Did your family have some sense of who might have done it?
Well, we had the rumor from the streets, you know, but the detective never really found anybody of substance. And so we like to think that the assailant came looking for my sister's boyfriend, living boyfriend, but we don't really know.
Right.
You know, the streets are just violent, you know, and people get killed all the time for no reason. And there's never a good reason anyway for people to be killed.
Right.
But nevertheless, people get gunned down all the time. And some of these cases don't get solved. And sadly, our case was not solved.
Yeah. So I haven't. Has the death penalty been as much of a national issue as you would like it to be? Or?
Well, the fact is, death sentences have gone down. They decreased in number for the last several years. People still receive them, though. In fact, there are parts of the country where people are more likely to get it than other parts of the country, because certain prosecutors tend to go for capital punishment. It shows they're tough on crime and so forth. And they use the guise of supporting the family members of those who have been murdered. But really, I believe it's to support their case to be reelected. But it's a big issue because, first of all, it's wrong. You know, it's wrong to kill people to show that killing is wrong. And then number two, it keeps victim relatives in limbo for sometimes a couple decades while the appeal process goes on. And then millions of dollars are spent by states that could be going to people who've lost loved ones to murder. Like in Ohio, my sister was killed 21 years ago. I think of all the millions of dollars spent in Ohio for capital cases and death row inmates since then. Well, people who lost loved ones to murder could have used that money to go on with their lives, to pay for counseling, tuition, rent, mortgage payments. Right. Because sometimes the breadwinner was the one that was killed, you know, and so there's not enough money in the family. And so that money could be used to help us to restore our lives, not to keep people in the court system suspended indefinitely and wasting the government's money, our taxpayer money. It's better to put that money in a better place to help family members who've lost loved ones to murder and to prevent people from going down the pathway of crimes, like investing in Head Start, programs like that.
Right.
Yeah.
My name is Bill Pelkey. I live in Anchorage, Alaska. This is my 25th Fast and Vigil that I've been to. I'm one of the co-founders of this event. And so this is actually the 100th day that I've been here in front of the court. 25 years ago, Marietta Yeager, a murder victim family member, and Rick Halperin, probably one of the leading abolitionists in the country, and I got together and decided we wanted to do something to commemorate the Supreme Court decisions on the death penalty. And so June 29th of 72 was the Furman decision, which emptied death row, and then the Gregg decision on July 2nd of 76 is when the Supreme Court said it was all right to start executing again. Mm-hmm. And so we want to do something to commemorate those dates. Mm-hmm.
Was there a personal story that led you to be active in the issue?
Yes. In 1985, May 14th, my grandmother was brutally murdered by four teenage girls. A 15-year-old girl by the name of Paula Cooper was deemed to be the ringleader, and she was sentenced to die in the electric chair. At first, I supported the decision, but then I became convinced that that's not what my grandmother would have wanted. That my grandmother would have, in fact, had love and compassion for this girl, for this girl's family. I felt she wanted someone in my family to have that same sort of love and compassion. Even though my Christian faith taught me that forgiveness was the right thing, love and compassion was another story. But so convinced that she would want me to have that, I actually begged my God in tears to give me love and compassion for Paula Cooper and her family, and do that on behalf of my grandmother, and I prayed it in Jesus' name. And then begin to think, well, I could write this girl a letter, I could tell her about my grandmother, share my grandmother's faith. And I realized that I no longer want her to die, and I want to do whatever I could do to try to help her. Mm-hmm. And I actually got involved in an international campaign to help get her off of death row. In 1989, she was taken off of death row, and her sentence was commuted to 60 years in prison. Mm-hmm. Once she got off of death row, I thought, well, my job is done. But then I heard about a march that was taking place in Florida in 1990, and it was to ignite the spiritual consciousness of churches in America about the issue of the death penalty. I thought, well, it was spiritual reasons why I was opposed to the death penalty. I wanted to go, so I was living in Indiana at the time. I filled my van up with gas and drove to Florida. And on that two-week march, with I met Sister Helen Prejean, who is one of the leading abolitionists in this country. Her story is told in the movie Dead Man Walking. But it was on that march where I dedicated my life to the abolition of the death penalty. And I've been working against the death penalty ever since. I began an organization in 1993 called the Journey of Hope from Violence to Healing, which is led by murder victim family members mm-hmm. that are opposed to the death penalty. And we do speaking tours around the country and around the world, sharing our stories. We talk about how the death penalty has nothing to do with the healing that a murder victim family member needs when a loved one's been killed, but how it just continues a cycle of violence. We promote forgiveness as a way to heal and restorative justice as a way to live. The journey has been to over 40 states and over 20 countries. And as we do our speaking tours, we're joined by family members who have loved ones on death row. They share what it's like to have somebody they love sitting in the jail cell waiting for the day the state's going to kill them. We're joined by people who have had loved ones already executed. And we're also joined by what we call exonerees, as people that were sentenced to death for crimes he didn't commit. In the United States alone, since the death penalty was reinstituted July 2nd of 76, over 160 people have been sentenced to death for crimes that they didn't commit. Fortunately, they were able to prove their innocence and were released before the state could kill them. But we still know there's many more people, innocent people, on death row. And as long as human beings decide who's going to live and who's going to die, we're going to make mistakes. And when it comes to the death penalty, there's no room for mistakes. Right. We're convinced the answer is love and compassion for all humanity. And if you have love and compassion for all humanity, you're not going to see anybody put into the death chamber and their life taken from them. It's impossible.
I know every now and then I see a case where someone's being released from prison and they've been found innocent. And invariably, it's this older black man who's been in jail for sometimes decades. And, I mean, these stories crop up every few months. I mean, does your work that you do connect with some of those cases?
Well, absolutely. In fact, I live in Alaska now, and Alaskans Against the Death Penalty, we're bringing up Derek Jameson the end of this month for our annual fundraising event. He was on death row in Ohio for 20 years, a young black man when he went in. Had no knowledge that a crime had even taken place. It was a false identification. But he was on death row for 20 years. He watched 54 people that he got to know while he was on death row that led off to their death. His mother died while he was on death row. He couldn't even go to her funeral or anything like that. But there, a lot of people, one of the people who's been coming here to the Fasten Vigil is Suji Graham. He was a young black man when he was sentenced to death in California, finally able to prove his innocence. And so he travels with us and speaks out. He's been speaking out here at the court.
Mm-hmm. Explain to those listening about restorative justice, what that means. I had a chance to speak to Fania Davis last year, and she does a lot of work with that in Oakland. But with like high school students and young people who are being kind of funneled into the prison industrial complex. But from your vantage point, how does restorative justice work?
Well, there's retributive justice and there's restorative justice. Retributive justice is a getting even sort of a thing. And restorative justice is trying to restore to where we should be in life. I visited with a girl that killed my grandmother eventually. It took 8 years before they would allow us to visit, but I was able to visit with her in prison. And I think that's one of the parts of restorative justice is being able to have communication with the person that has done you harm. It doesn't always require forgiveness, but often forgiveness comes with restorative justice. I'm a member of an organization called Restorative Justice International, run by a lady by the name of Lisa Ray out of Nevada now. But I'm very much a proponent of restorative justice.
So can you tell us what that was like, visiting her?
Yes. We began to write letters because they wouldn't allow us to visit, and it actually took 8 years before I was able to visit with her the first time. Mm-hmm. And she was off death row by the time I was able to visit her. But when I visited with her, I did not talk about the crime, but we had been corresponding for years, and so we talked about friends that we knew and had in common. That sort of thing. The thing that stuck out most in my mind after that first visit was a 3-hour drive home where the word wonderful, wonderful, wonderful kept crossing my mind, because I had just met this person who had done such a terrible thing to my grandmother, such a terrible thing to our family, and yet I didn't have the hate and the anger and the desire for revenge that would be so easy to have. But I had the kind of love for her that I believe God wants us to have for each of his creation. And to me, that was wonderful.
Okay. Where did you visit her?
In Indiana, at the Indiana Women's Prison in Indianapolis. And I was living in Gary, Indiana at the time.
And what year was that?
The first time I visited her was Thanksgiving Day of 1994. Okay. And the crime took place in 1985. But I started to try to visit her after November 2nd of 1986, where I had begged God to give me love and compassion.
So this action, the 25th anniversary, what do you hope comes out of it?
Well, there's a lot of people that are here for the first time, and especially young people, and it takes, for a movement to be successful, it's got to have the young people. So I'm excited to see some of the young people that are here and are actually even fasting for the cause. I think it'll inspire them to go back to their states and to do more work, to be more involved.
And that will do it for today's show. I want to thank my guests, Gerald Horn and Fred Brabner. And thanks to Chantel James for her reporting. And thanks to our summer interns, Nicholas Aponza, Shailene Parham, Donald Postel, Ezra Reed, Sherelle Walters, and David Williams. The music we played this hour included cuts from Drake's new album, Scorpion. This is On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital on Pacifica Radio. You can reach us and listen to complete versions of our shows on our website, onthegroundshow.org. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. I'm Esther Averam. Until next week, keep raising your voice. peace.
And that brings to a close On the Ground Radio for today. Stay tuned, because in a minute or so, we'll be hearing Air Cascadia reporting live from Occupy ICE PDX for a half an hour. Interviews and updates from the encampment at Portland's Immigration Field Office. And at 10:30, there's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, The Dirt Bag answers your gardening questions. All that coming up on KBOO following these announcements.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor an afternoon with Wahyu and Friends Saturday, July 14th from 2 to 5 p.m. in Lake Oswego. Gamelan Wahyu are hosting a fundraising event to help members study abroad in Bali during the summer of 2019. Performers include Agents of Echo, Dolphin Midwives, and Gamelan Wahyu. Refreshments will be provided. Again, that's an afternoon with Wahyu and Friends, Saturday, July 14th from 2 to 5 p.m. at 3548 Lakeview Boulevard in Lake Oswego. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm Rick Mitchell, and I would like to invite you to check out my program, Jazz in the New Millennium, at kboo.fm. Each one-hour program focuses on a living jazz artist, putting their work in historical perspective, from their earliest recordings to their most recent. The current season features such legends as McCoy Tyner, Wynton Marsalis, and Dee Dee Bridgewater, as well as rising stars Julian Lage, Joy Alexander, and Tia Fuller. New shows are posted weekly, and you can also find the complete first season. The program is syndicated nationally by the African American Public Radio Consortium, but it can be heard anytime on KBOO's website by going to the drop-down menu on the homepage, clicking on Audio, then Podcasts, and scrolling down to the Jazz in the New Millennium page. That's Jazz in the New Millennium with Rick Mitchell at kboo.fm.